7 years ago, Rory Stewart walked across Afghanistan alone. And just 2 years later, he served as a deputy governor of a province in southern Iraq. Well, last year, he joined the Ivy League when he was appointed Ryan Professor of Human Rights at Harvard University and the director of the Harvard Kennedy School's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. But as CEO of a charitable organization called the Turquoise Mountain Foundation, he maintains his link to Afghanistan. He is also the author of The Places in Between, The Prince of Marshes, and Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq. I'm very pleased to welcome Rory Stewart back to our show. Hello. And I guess if people listen to that, they think, well, he has a lot more of a connection to Iraq than he does to Afghanistan. But Afghanistan really was the key for you?
Afghanistan was the key for me. Afghanistan's where I've been living for most of the last 3.5 years. And Afghanistan was the country which I first fell in love with on my walk in 2001, 2002.
So you're living in Afghanistan and then in Cambridge, Mass?
I moved from Afghanistan to Cambridge. So I set up this small nonprofit in Kabul at the end of 2005 and lived there for 3 years. And then in January, I took up my position in Cambridge. Now I go back about every 8 weeks. So I was there last month. I'll be there next month.
President Obama has said that he'll send an additional 17,000 troops to Afghanistan this spring and summer, and he's complained that the war in Afghanistan has been going in the wrong direction. Do you think that more troops will help stabilize the country?
I don't believe they will. I think the problems in Afghanistan are much more troubling longer-term issues. They're about how a country where 75-80% of the population can't read and write, where half the civil servants don't have a high school education, which has been through 30 years of war, how a country like that can begin to create a legitimate, effective nation and deliver services to people. And I think the deployment of 17,000 troops for a short period of time is more likely to make things worse than better.
And then we have the situation of Hamid Karzai, who has been coming under increasing criticism for being an ineffective leader and allowing corruption to flourish. Do you think that he's a problem? If we replace him, will things get any better?
Again, the fundamental problems of Afghanistan are structural. This is a very poor, impoverished, traumatized country, and it's probably the fourth poorest country in the world, according to the UN. It's right down there with Chad. It's 30 years behind Pakistan. So yes, there's immense corruption. There's real lack of security. Many people really struggle to find any firewood during the winter, struggle to feed themselves in the central mountains. You could replace the president, but the challenges that are being faced that go well beyond the charisma or the leadership of a single individual.
President Karzai has been complaining about the increase in civilian casualties over the past few months. Has that been undermining support for an American presence from the Afghan people?
For sure. Civilian casualties are an incredibly aggravating issue. One can understand, of course, that these are accidental, that the U.S. military doesn't intend to do these things, but the Taliban are able to exploit all these casualties as great propaganda victories, and ordinary Afghans are bewildered. We, in the 1980s, when I say we, I mean the CIA, the British intelligence services, the Pakistan intelligence services, invested very heavily in convincing Afghans that their duty was to fight a jihad, a holy war against foreign military occupation. And aerial bombardments and the deployment of additional troops, of course, play into that narrative. They allow Afghans to feel that they're living under a foreign military occupation and that they have an obligation, if not to fight us, then at least to provide passive acquiescence to people like the Taliban who are doing so.
What about the violence of the Taliban? The violence, bombing girls' schools and beheading officials.
The violence of the Taliban, again, is horrendous.
But is that having a negative effect? Is it the public feel like it's caught between the two, or would they prefer the Taliban, who they saw as their saviors earlier at the time when the Mujahideen were all bombarding each other in a hope to gain power?
I think if you're a villager, and this, of course, is a massive simplification, but roughly speaking, the experience is like this. You're in your village, and at night the Taliban turn up, and you invite them into your house, and you give them a cup of tea and some nuts and raisins, and you have a chat. And you don't really like them. You've let them into your house because they've got guns. They probably sit in your house and give you a very pompous lecture about religion. You're quite pleased to see the back of them when they leave. But then the next day, maybe the Afghan police turn up in a pickup truck. They're waving weapons around. They're not wearing proper uniforms. They may be insulting the women in your house. Or maybe the coalition troops, American or Canadian or British troops, come in and kick down the door or perhaps start searching through your personal possessions for guns. You're stuck in a situation where you don't like any of these people. You really want to be left alone. These villages, through 30 years of war, have learnt that they're generally in a better situation when they see as little as possible of outside groups of armed men. However, if the Taliban present themselves as reasonably pious, they are, after all, predominantly Afghan. You may be, for example, from a Pashtun community. Almost all the Taliban are Pashtun. There are ways in which the Taliban can exploit that to at least put you in a position, not that you're going to actively support them necessarily or carry guns on their behalf, but feel sufficient sympathy for them not to report them to the coalition.
Well, how important are tribal loyalties in Afghanistan?
Tribal loyalties are disintegrating. One of the problems in dealing with a country like Afghanistan is that it's under a process of rapid modernization. Millions more people are now living in Kabul compared to even 4 years ago. Millions of refugees have returned to the country. People are walking around with strange new fashions, jeans covered in zips, mobile telephones blossoming everywhere. The Taliban themselves don't really use tribal structures. The communist government of the 1980s destroyed tribal structures. So it's not really a tribal society. It's a classic developing country, much like much of sub-Saharan Africa. It's oscillating between a very young population, probably the majority of the population is under 25.
Well, the reason I ask is because you said that most of the Taliban were Pashtun, and the Pashtun, of course, not only in the area where they have been strongest in Afghanistan, but also in Pakistan.
That's absolutely right. The British in the 1880s drew this line. British in the 1880s drew this line called the Durand Line, which divides Afghanistan from Pakistan, and it's very arbitrary. You end up with very similar groups on both sides of the border. It's a very artificial boundary. And so all these problems that you're talking about in Afghanistan have their parallel in Pakistan.
Do you think that the Taliban's recent attempts to increase their power in Pakistan have hurt their resurgence in Afghanistan? Have they been distracted?
I don't believe it's a fundamental distraction from their efforts in Afghanistan, because I don't believe these are really members of a single coherent group. In other words, it wouldn't be like the U.S. military dividing its operations between two countries. The majority of these people that we label as Taliban include an enormous number of auxiliaries drawn from these local areas. And the Pakistan Taliban defines itself institutionally as quite separate from the Afghan Taliban. They've taken a franchise on the name Taliban.
A couple of months ago, Admiral Michael Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, claimed that Pakistan's intelligence service, the ISI, has close links with al-Qaeda and the Taliban network, and he warned that the ISI is offering logistical support to them. So is Pakistan being hoisted by its own petard now that the Taliban is threatening to, well, I don't know whether how serious the threat is, but looked like it actually was a serious threat to take over the country?
I think the response from the Pakistanis is going to be much more effective than we acknowledge. Pakistan is a very serious state. The Pakistan military is a very serious army.
650,000 people and a substantive reserve force, and Taliban, I understand, 35,000 to 50,000 members.
Yes. Above and beyond these numbers, though, Pakistan is 30 years ahead of Afghanistan on almost every indicator. Its police, its army, its civil service, even its legitimate economic structures are much more developed. This is a country where if the Pakistan government, if Pakistan people desire to confront these problems, I think they certainly can solve them. They have the wherewithal to do so.
But you say if they desire to do it, and isn't there a split within the Pakistani government? The ISI still seems to have sympathy toward the Taliban, even though it doesn't seem to share many ideological things with it.
Fundamentally, the problem in Pakistan is that the Pakistan army still believes that the number one strategic threat to Pakistan comes from India, not from the Taliban or from the tribal areas. Their training, their doctrine, their entire experience, their history is connected with preparing to fight India. And all these groups, from the Taliban to the smaller jihadi groups that they used to fight in Kashmir and who were connected to the bombings in Mumbai, were part of the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, that's the Pakistan Military Intelligence's attempts to prepare a fifth column against India. The question then is, how do you begin to change these kinds of attitudes? We face a similar challenge here in the United States. How would one, for example, convince the current administration that it is a bad thing to send another 17,000 troops to Afghanistan?
Especially since the president said he was going to switch our focus from Iraq to Afghanistan.
Right. So without simplifying too much, there's a kind of analogy. The U.S. administration, the Pakistan army, are both prisoners of their own ideology, their own history, their own traditions. And it's very difficult, even in situations of urgent crisis, to actually say, come on, why are you doing this? Why are you looking at India rather than Pakistan? Or in the case of the United States, why are you looking at Afghanistan, not Pakistan?
Well, in the case of Pakistan with Afghanistan, the United States has been applying a lot more pressure on the Pakistani military to take what's going on the borders more seriously. Do you think that it's likely to happen that the army will fulfill its promise and actually do something on the border?
I think the Pakistan army will eventually do something, yes. But the problem for the United States in dealing with Pakistan is that our options are very, very limited. This is a country of nearly 200 million people. This is a Islamic society, which is not very interested in having the United States or American soldiers inside that country. In a sense, it's a model for what we're going to have to deal with for the next 20, 30 years, which is how on earth does a superpower deal with countries which may be too big and too complicated for us to be able to direct or micromanage.
Have you been consulted in Washington?
I've spoken to some people in Washington, yes.
And what's been their response to what you're saying? Because it's opposite to what we've been hearing.
So I think what people in Washington would say is that they have very modest objectives. All they're trying to do is defeat al-Qaeda, defeat the Taliban, stabilize Pakistan, bring some kind of minimally effective state into Afghanistan, deliver a bit of development. And my problem is convincing them that those things which sound very modest, sound very simple, are in fact incredibly ambitious. And if achievable at all, achievable over a 30, 40-year time frame, not over a 5-year time frame.
My guest is Rory Stewart, who is serving these days as Ryan Professor of Human Rights at Harvard University and Director of the Harvard Kennedy School's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. But he also visits Afghanistan once every 8 weeks or so. And we're talking about the current situation in Afghanistan. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Rory Stewart, and we're talking about Afghanistan today. Tell me a bit about the mission of the Turquoise Mountain Foundation that you have founded.
Turquoise Mountain is a community-led nonprofit working in the center of the historic city of Kabul. This is a city which has a history stretching back over 2,500 years, and we're working in an area of narrow mud streets with a very poor community where about 1 in 5 children die before the age of 5, where the average life expectancy is about 37. This is a community that came to us at the end of 2005 and worked with us to try to do two main things. One of them is to preserve the traditional crafts and skills of this area. This was an area of traditional craftspeople, but also the extraordinary architectural heritage, because the mayor of Kabul at that period wanted to demolish this amazing historic commercial center of the city and replace it with a 1976 East German master plan. So it's been a very complicated, very, very enthralling, very informative, very fulfilling project for me over the last 3.5 years, which is to say we've had to build an organization from one person to now 450 people. We've set up an elementary school with more girls than boys in that school, clinics, literacy programs, brought in water, sewerage, drainage, rebuilt about 65 buildings, set up an art school, and we're now selling these products internationally in order to generate the incomes to keep this part of the old city going into the future.
How destructive was the Taliban period in regards to the arts?
Taliban period was terrible in regard to the arts. Afghanistan is a place that was a center of Islamic civilization. If you go back to the 12th century, the great tiles on the minaret of Jam, or in the 14th century, the mosques in western Afghanistan, a place like Herat, were the wonders of the ancient world. This was the center of an empire that stretched at times from Delhi to Baghdad. Some of the most famous miniature painters, a man called Behzad, for example, comes from Afghanistan. And all of this the Taliban turned against. Our chief miniature painter, who exists in a tradition going all the way back to 1500, all the way back to Behzad, was found by the Taliban in a car with some pictures and was beaten with rubber hoses and had to run away to Pakistan. So,
what reason?
Because
I mean, I understand why they blew up the Buddha. They said that that was an unacceptable, a symbol of an unacceptable religion. But we're talking about Islamic art here, aren't we?
Even within Islamic art, the Taliban disagree. They believe faces should not be shown in Islamic art. And fundamental to the miniature painting tradition, which Afghanistan is so famous for, is human faces in these miniature paintings. So for us, working with women and with men in Afghanistan, a lot of what we're doing is trying to restore a positive sense of national identity, remind people that Afghanistan represents much more as a proud Islamic country than the Taliban represented.
And what about the community and the Afghan government? Are they supporting your efforts?
The community has been fantastic. They are very funny, very tricky. This is a very poor slum area of the city. And I can't, you know, pretend that any of these things, and anyone who has worked on projects of urban regeneration or poverty in the United States will recognize these things. We're dealing with people who are drug addicts. We're dealing with a situation where the garbage was nearly 7 feet deep in the streets. We're dealing with gangsters, champion wrestlers, local religious leaders. But basically, the community has put their weight behind this project. It was they, for example, who drove us to set up the elementary school. They provided the land for free, the buildings for free. They worked with us to make sure that we had girls in those classrooms. We've seen extraordinary things from the women in the old city working on embroidery projects. And all of this takes place without any coalition military presence. There are no foreign troops anywhere near this project. This is a project where the community works with us in order to regenerate that area.
You mentioned the drug addicts. How much of Afghanistan's opium production is going back into the Afghan population?
Very little compared to how much is going to Europe or how much is going to Iran, for example. I've been to villages in Iran where 70% of the people in the village are opium addicts. Mm-hmm. In Afghanistan at the moment, they're largely exporters rather than users.
And this is paying to some degree for the Taliban's efforts. But also, we've seen some people connected with the government skimming profits from the opium trade.
Essentially, if you ask what Afghanistan's economy is, what its competitive advantage is, the answer would be this is the only country on earth that can produce 93% of the world's heroin and still receive $4 billion a year in international aid. And almost all the money in the country comes from one of those two sources. Doesn't matter whether you're talking about the Taliban or you're talking about the government or you're talking about a corrupt police chief or you're talking about a labor in Kabul. Those are the two economic streams of this country.
You mentioned earlier that people are returning. They left during the Taliban period?
Correct. The population of Kabul, and it's very difficult to put a figure on this, but has probably quadrupled.
And where did they go?
They mostly went to Pakistan or to Iran.
I'm assuming that most of the people who left were professional people, people who would have felt most endangered by the Taliban. Are we seeing doctors return, teachers?
To some extent, but Afghanistan is very short of professional people. A lot of the professional classes in Afghanistan settled in Europe and the United States and are not coming back. So unfortunately, a lot of these people returning from Pakistan and Iran don't have particular skills. They've been living in refugee camps for 15, 20 years.
What percentage of the population can be described as Islamic fundamentalist?
I would say that the majority of the Afghan population in rural areas are conservative, pious. Probably, I mean, I don't know how to put a finger on this, but in my office staff, for example, every single member of those 450 staff prays five times a day. Every single one of them fasts during the month of Ramadan. This would not be true, for example, if you were in Turkey or Indonesia.
But to some degree in Pakistan, as we saw when that video of the teenage girl was being beaten because she had talked with a man. Many people in Pakistan were horrified, but many others said, well, that was a just punishment.
When you're dealing with a conservative religious community, you are going to have those kind of divisions. We had these divisions in Massachusetts, too. I mean, these are things that any society based on religion goes through, questions of morality, questions of how to deal with women, questions of what the religion is really about. But Afghanistan, like Pakistan, is a place that has a strong alternative tradition of Islam, a Sufi tradition of Islam, which would be in Western terms seen as much more progressive, much more liberal, much more tolerant of diversity of views. The Hazara population in central Afghanistan has a much more progressive attitude generally towards women. 85 women from a single sub-district called Jaggery sat the examinations for Kabul University this year. And certainly our experience working with Afghan communities is that although communities may not be sending their women to school, it's very, very rare after you've had a conversation with a household that you can't overcome that and find some way of convincing the father, it's usually the father in that case, to send their daughter to school.
Is this a society that's in transition? There's a film called Afghan Star, which is about an Afghan TV version of America, or the same kind of show as American Idol. And it struck me as totally opposite to everything that I'd heard about Afghanistan.
Well, I love that program. And I mean, I love what it's saying, which is to remind people that, you know, we somehow see Afghanistan for some reason. I think this is partly to do with the way the New York Times does stuff, through these wonderfully dramatic black and white photographs, generally of suffering, of blood, of burn wards, of children beating each other, of extreme poverty. In fact, of course, you also need to see Afghanistan the way we might see India, which is to say color, humor, life, crowded markets. And one of the great ways in which Afghan Star, that documentary, operates is by reminding people that this is a modern South Asian developing country with all the kind of vigor, humor, and diversity that you'd expect.
But it also sounds like it's like so many other places, caught up in certain Western values, even though everything that I associate with al-Qaeda and the Taliban is a rejection of Western values.
Absolutely. And even, of course, al-Qaeda and the Taliban, without sounding too academic about this, are caught up with very interesting trends of globalization. It's not just about the way they use the internet or the way they use television. Even their very simplistic attachment to a text, the way in which they use the Quran, their lack of respect for religious authority, is in fact something which has parallels with the way that fundamentalist Christians operate in the United States as much as it does with anything in the history of Islam.
My guest is Rory Stewart. We're talking about Afghanistan. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What did you learn about Afghanistan by walking across it that you might not have learned any other way?
I think I learned, first of all, the incredible diversity of these villages, how in a single valley you can go from a village controlled by a mullah to a village controlled by a tribal chief to a village where a social revolution has happened and some quite unknown person is now controlling it. I had a strong sense of how communities operate without government, the way in which they control their own justice, their insecurity, their own economic affairs. I also had...
Wait, that was 7 years ago. Was it, had the Taliban been routed out at that point?
No, the Taliban was still technically in control of some of these areas as I walked through, but in effect, nobody had really been in control of these areas for nearly 30 years. If, in fact, they'd actually been under much control at all, because basically, even in the 1970s, these communities had very little to do with the government in terms of receipt of services or paying taxes. But I suppose the other thing that I took away is a very strong sense, along with conservatism, intolerance, and all the kinds of things you might expect in a remote rural society, of energy, generosity, dignity, happiness. I mean, these are communities where one often really felt that they had rich meaning in their lives, despite the fact that people may not have gone 3 hours walk from their village in their lives, despite the fact that they, you know, may have thought the local market town was as distant as Paris. There was a sense in which people were connecting in ways that were recognizably inspiring, recognizably impressive.
Despite the situation at that time, was it safer than it is today? Because some aid agencies have pulled out of Afghanistan because of the dangers of operating there. Would you walk across Afghanistan now?
I think walking across Afghanistan then as now is largely to do with communities looking after you. Would I do it again? Not sure. It was pretty dangerous the first time, but I suspect that I'd be able to do it as easily now as I could then. And I think this is an important point. I mean, the reason I could make it safely across the country was nothing to do with coalition troops, because there weren't any coalition troops, nothing to do with the Afghan government, because there wasn't any Afghan government. I was passed like a parcel from community to community, from village to village. And one's security stands or falls with the respect of the community.
And why did they like you so much?
I didn't think they liked me so much. I think they felt a strong sense of obligation to strangers, to travelers, to guests. I turned up, I remember, in a village called Dahanis Yasang, and a man called Habibullah Shelwa said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to Kamenj." And he said, "Just give me a minute." He popped inside, picked up his rifle, changed his shoes, and walked with me on a 70-mile round trip, a three-day round trip to get me to Kamenj and back again, without a moment's thought. And he does that because that's the way that meaning is shaped in his life. That's the way he views himself as a person.
You have witnessed two insurgencies in Iraq when you were actually running one of the provinces as deputy governor, and the one that's currently in Afghanistan. Are there any similarities?
I think there are similarities. I think in both cases, it's quite easy in the modern world to portray yourself as fighting for your country, Iraq or Afghanistan, and Islam against a foreign military occupation. But we should be very cautious in drawing the analogies too closely because, in fact, Iraq is very, very different to Afghanistan. The surge, I believe, worked in Iraq, and I was in Baghdad about 6 weeks ago. I believe that surge worked because the politics worked, because the Baghdad government is a mass political-based Shia government that was winning, that was driving the Sunni groups out of neighborhood after neighborhood in Baghdad, and that the Sunni tribal groups themselves were relatively coherent, feeling under pressure, but still able to pose a sufficient threat to be worth dealing with, and that General Petraeus's genius was to cut a political deal, was to recognize that the Sons of Iraq should be given money, these Sunni tribal groups should be brought on board and paid to cooperate, but that kind of deal will not work in Afghanistan because the Karzai government is not as strong, credible, and legitimate as the al-Maliki government, and the tribal groups do not have anything like the kind of significance, coherence, or links to the central government that they do in Iraq.
Is there tension between the Sunnis and the Shiites in Afghanistan?
There certainly is, and one of the problems during the Taliban period is the Taliban are a Sunni movement, and they conducted near-genocidal policies against the Hazara in central Afghanistan, particularly down the central Sarjangal Valley, where I walked for 4.5 days and saw village after village burnt to the ground and abandoned.
So what do you think the United States should do to improve the situation? You said that you don't believe that sending more troops is going to help. You talked in very grand terms about illiteracy and poverty, but that's not something you can resolve immediately.
I think the United States needs to take a step back. It needs to find some distance. It needs to realize that the United States has many obligations in the world and that putting nearly 100,000 troops on the ground, if you count the NATO allies as well, is going to erode American credibility. It's going to cost American lives. It's going to cost Afghan lives. It's not going to achieve what we claim we're there to achieve. In other words, it's not going to create an effective, legitimate state anytime soon. So instead, what we need is a solution which we can be proud of, a solution which defends our national security, which says we can do something to contain and manage this situation, but that the national security solution needs to be a long-term one. If the state's not going to stabilize anytime soon, then we're going to have to be dealing with the threats from Afghanistan over 30 or 40 years. And if we have to be there for 30 or 40 years, we need a much lighter footprint. We need far fewer troops. We can't spend $100 billion a year, have 90,000 troops on the ground. So national security, a lighter footprint. And in terms of development efforts, this is the United States. We believe that we should be doing good in the world. In order to keep consent, even for these counter-terrorist operations, we should be doing things for the Afghan people, but we should be doing them for their own sake too. There are so many opportunities we're missing in the center and the north of the country, communities who want to work with us, with whom we are not working. We say you can't do development without security, but in effect, in places where there's security, we don't give them development. We only try to put development into the insurgency areas. So a huge shift, and I think we might find that although that we can do less than we pretend, we can probably achieve much more than we fear.
I think there are a lot of Americans who think that if we simply capture Osama bin Laden and the Mullah Omar, that everything will be resolved.
Yeah. I think that may help in terms of domestic politics.
In the same way that capturing Saddam Hussein helped with Iraq, but it didn't necessarily help with the Iraqis?
Exactly. And the phenomenon which are represented by these people remains, and remains a long-term problem, something that I believe will gradually fall away. I mean, in the end, I think this is senseless, idiotic, and barbaric, the conduct of al-Qaeda, and I think there's every reason in the world to believe that humans can find a more positive form of meaning than these kinds of activities. But That's not going to happen overnight. And what we have to do is keep flexible, keep light, keep engaged, and keep doing what we can do traditionally to steer people in a more positive direction.
What is the Afghan attitude toward al-Qaeda? After all, it is really an outside group.
I don't think Afghans are particularly in favor of al-Qaeda. I think they see them as non-Afghan. They blame them for the invasion. Many of them think that the Taliban kept security, but al-Qaeda were murderous terrorists. So I think we need to capitalize on that. We need to capitalize on that ambivalence, that antipathy, which I think exists amongst many Muslims in relation to these kinds of bombings.
Rory Stewart is Ryan Professor of Human Rights at Harvard University, Director of the Harvard Kennedy School's Carr Center for Human Rights Policy. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much indeed.